Good evening and welcome to the Columbia Forum. This evening's speaker is economist Joe Courtwright. He's the principal economist for Impressa Consulting and chair of a new think tank called City Observer. The Atlantic magazine recently published an article online written by Mr. Courtwright on the economic effects of gentrification. Tonight, Mr. Courtwright will discuss the outlook for Oregon economy in 2016. The forum is hosted by Steve Forrester. We join our speaker, already in progress.
One salient piece of my biography that Steve left out, which is that for about a dozen years, I worked for the Oregon legislature. You probably all know the Oregon legislature. They meet periodically in Salem and make laws. And I was their chief staff person for what was called the Committee on Trade and Economic Development. And so I regularly worked with a joint group of House and Senate legislators, usually 13 members. And the one skill that I carried away from my dozen years of the state legislature is they never would have let me talk this long without interrupting me with a question. So I'm very adept at working in an environment where I'm being peppered with questions, and they don't necessarily have to be nice questions, from the audience. So it'll be probably more interesting to me and certainly more interesting to you if, you know, periodically I say something or bring up some topic. If you have a question you want to challenge what I say or prod me to give more detail or evidence for what I say, I'll be happy to do that. The more this is a conversation and less a monologue from an economist, I think the happier everyone will be. So with that as a very quick introduction, let me see if I get this technology to work. I've discovered this remarkable new thing called PowerPoint. It lets you project images. Maybe none of you have ever seen one of these before. I do have a few slides, probably most so you don't have to look at me. You can look at some other stuff instead that perhaps is more interesting and attractive, and particularly this time. So I'm going to talk about what I'm calling Oregon's next economy, which we're very much in the business of creating right now, and what I think the contours of that economy look like, how it's different from the historical economy that we've had in Oregon, and what the critical factors are that will determine how successful we are as a state, and how places can prosper in really what is a global and a knowledge-based economy today, which is very different than the kind of economy that we've grown up in, that our state was formed in, that the US economy has performed in, and that we're all very familiar with. So that's sort of the general theme I'd like to talk about. You know, 2016 is another year. If we want to delve into the economic forecast, I'm happy to talk about that. But I really want to talk about sort of the broader contours, the big forces that are shaping economies and economic success. And then be happy to talk either during the presentation or when I've gone through an endless series of slides, talk about anything that's on your mind as well. So. As Steve alluded to, I'm running a new think tank. It's called City Observatory. If you don't get enough boring slides from this presentation, you can download even more from our website called cityobservatory.org. And we're funded by the Knight Foundation, not Phil Knight of Portland, but the John S. and James L. Knight brothers, who've founded a series of newspapers, the Knight Ritter newspaper chain around the country. Their legacy is really supporting a number of civic endeavors, and our City Observatory is one of the things that they have cast a favorable eye upon. We write daily about issues about the economy, particularly as it affects cities, but a lot of the issues that we deal with have very wide applicability, and I'll be drawing from the research that we do. I'm sorry. And I could talk about our mission. We're a think tank. We're supported by Knight Foundation. We try to do smart things, but you'll be the judge of that. So here's a quick synopsis of the points that I'd like to talk about today. First of all, I just want to touch on very briefly our current economic situation. There are certain set of indicators, some numbers that economists look at to describe how well an economy is performing. I'll show you some of those, show you what they looked like when I was here 5 years ago and how much better they look today. Then I want to step back a little bit and talk about sort of the metaphors that we use to make sense of a very complex thing we all call the economy, because none of us really have the cognitive skills to understand something that is really as big and complex as even the Oregon economy, much less the national or the global economy. So we do what Homo sapiens have been doing for, you know, 10,000 or 50,000 years. We use really simple metaphors to make sense of very complex situations. And sometimes those metaphors are very useful in helping us simplify things in a way that we can make decisions. But a lot of times, those metaphors, we overuse them or we misuse them. And I'll talk about some sort of shop-worn metaphors that we might need to discard or retool, particularly here in Oregon. Then I want to talk about talent and place, because those are the two ingredients. Those are the two things that are intersecting that determine whether places are successful in economy: the kind of people that you have in a place and the kind of place that attracts and holds people in place. And I'll elaborate on that in more detail. I'll talk a little bit about the theme of our work at City Observatory, which is a shortage of cities, which may seem a little bit odd to you. But I'll explain what we mean by that and why we think it's so important to understanding what's happening with the economy. And then finally, I'll conclude by talking about what we regard as a series of myths and realities. There are some myths that we're carrying around in our head that reflect the way the economy used to be, and I'm going to talk about why those things have changed and why we need to discard those myths and what some of the new realities are. So that's my roadmap for the next, you know, I don't know, 30, 40 minutes, and then we'll definitely throw it open for questions. So, everybody okay with that? You want to stop and you want to get more dessert or coffee, or the bar looks like it's still open, so if you need comfort from that angle, please go ahead. So let me roll the calendar back to 5 years ago when I was in Astoria last. This is the slide that I threw up on a screen in February 2010 talking about finding the new normal. There was snow on the mountain then. There's maybe a little bit of snow today, but not so much. And I'm sorry, a little heavy-handed here on the clicker. This is what the Oregon economy and the national economy looked like when I was here last. We were plunging into what was, at the national level, the worst economic downturn in more than seven decades. You know, since 1929, the worst decade, the worst downturn. And you basically, all those lines show the recessions from the late 1940s and 50s through the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, and showed how this recession was both deeper and more prolonged than those recessions. So if it seemed like 5 years ago that we were in tough shape nationally, it was certainly the case. But when I talked to you in February 2010, we had just hit bottom. We hit bottom and we were starting very gradually to move up. I don't have this chart, but the state of Oregon, roughly speaking, in the latter part of 2014, basically crossed over the point where we climbed out of this trough. We fell really abruptly, and we'd grown out of it by the roughly the middle of 2014. And today, the Oregon economy is growing again. Another salient factor from then was this is what the unemployment rate chart looked like when I talked to you in early 2010. Very, very scary numbers. The U.S. economy was in free fall. The unemployment rate was just literally spiking at that point. And the good news is that things have really turned a corner since I talked to you last. Maybe I should have stayed away. I don't know if it's an ominous sign that The Economist shows up. Last time was here, really at the bottom. And again, you see it really clearly here. These are numbers from the state economist. I'm just going to step over here, so bear with me. I mean, you can just see how deep this problem is. It's the worst cumulative downturn that we've experienced in Oregon in quite some time. Actually, and this is left off the chart here, but that recession of the early 1980s was a little bit worse than this this last one for us, although it was not as it was considerably less severe for the nation as a whole. But we've climbed out of that recession. The Oregon economy is growing again, and Oregon is the dark line. The dashed lighter blue line there is the United States, and you can see that Oregon's economy is actually growing more robustly than the United States as a whole. And one of the things that I think is a problem in Oregon is sometimes I think we're a little too pessimistic about the economy. We pay a lot of attention to those troughs and those downturns, but it's actually the case that pretty much every time the U.S. economy is healthy, the Oregon economy outperforms the national economy. So if things are bad nationally, it's hard for us. But if the U.S. economy is even in adequate shape, we tend to outgrow it. And I'll just point that out on this chart. You notice that in every case, when those when the U.S. lines are kind of one of their mountain periods, that dashed line is up. The solid blue line is well above it. So I'll just show you.
So over here, in the 1980s, we were growing faster. That dark blue line is higher. In the mid-1990s, we were growing faster. In the last recovery, the mid-2000s, early 2000s, we were growing faster. And once again, we are growing faster than the U.S. average. So a healthy national economy kind of sets the stage for Oregon's economy to do well. And there's nothing inherently, what that tells me is, and should tell you, is there's nothing inherently wrong with the Oregon economy. As long as the U.S. economy is healthy, we tend to do relatively well. And as a result, our unemployment rate, which was really high, it peaked at just under 12% when I was here 5 years ago, has been steadily, slowly, but steadily moving downward. And we're now at a rate statewide of about 5.5% seasonally adjusted. So that rate is coming down to where we would like it to be. It's still a couple of points above the national average, but that's typically where Oregon is, a couple of tenths of a point of above the national average. So the economy is getting better. And the other thing that's a particularly encouraging sign is incomes in Oregon are rising, and rising not just in the aggregate, but rising relative to the rest of the nation. And one of the long-term problems that Oregon has faced is that our wages, our earnings for a long time had eroded relative to the national average. So the 100% here would be the average income and the average wages of an American worker. And if you can remember back to the late 1970s, it was the case that Oregon's average per capita income was a little bit higher, just over 100% of the national average. And then that big recession we had in the 1980s, our income fell to about 10 points below the national average. And it recovered a little bit in the 1990s, as you see there. But then again, it tended to deteriorate again when the economy got weak. The really hopeful sign for this recovery, which is right here at the very end here, is these two nice little upticks in the average wage and average income. That tells you that Oregon and its workers are becoming more productive and are more highly paid relative to the rest of the United States. So a very hopeful sign for the Oregon economy. And maybe I should stop there and just say, okay, we're all done, because that's really good news. One of the, you know, the other things you like to do, I mean, one of the adages they say about economists is never make predictions, especially about the future. And, you know, I knew that a journalist had been at my last talk, so I would be held accountable for what I said. But it turns out that one of the things that I told you in 2010 was approximately correct. One of the things that I wrote, and this is the slide from that presentation, was housing won't be the ticket out of this recession. And that was kind of a controversial challenge or controversial claim to make, because every single other recession that we had for 50 years in the United States, housing led the way out of the recession. You know, it was always the Federal Reserve relaxing its interest rate policy, making mortgages more affordable, that led to a big surge in single family housing growth, that led to the construction industry doing well and creating jobs, that helped clearly the forest products industry, and here in Oregon, the nursery industry, and a whole series of other industries. That's not what happened in this recovery. Housing is actually still very, very weak, particularly the construction of new single family homes. So I want to say, this is one, and I like to celebrate these when you get them right, but this is one that I got right, was that housing has not been the ticket out. And I'll return to this housing issue, because I don't expect that to change dramatically in the next few years. And as you see here, the single family industry has these two lines show you the right-hand axis is multifamily new construction. The left-hand axis is single family. The brownish line is single family homes. The blue line is multifamily. And you can see that multifamily construction, chiefly apartments, has rebounded to its historic levels. It's doing quite well, about 350,000 units a year. Meanwhile, single family housing has done technically what economists would call the dead cat bounce. Okay, it fell down and it stayed down. And the single family industry is still extremely weak. Even though
We have historically low interest rates. A lot of the measures of what are called housing affordability are at very desirable levels. We're not seeing a big surge in either single-family home prices or in single-family construction. So as I said, I think the housing market in the United States has fundamentally changed, and that's part of the new normal that I'll return to talking about before we adjourn this evening. The other thing that I need to say about this economy, and it's true here in Oregon, but it's also true nationally, is this recovery is being led by what happens in urban areas, by what happens in big cities. And that's especially true here in Oregon. So this is, again, a chart that I borrowed from my colleagues at the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis, the state economist's office. The light blue line shows you the job growth during the recession for urban Oregon, basically Portland, Salem, Eugene, Medford, Bend, and then rural Oregon, the rest of the state. And you can see there very clearly, urban Oregon started coming back right after I talked here in February of 2010 and has been growing very aggressively. Rural Oregon bumped along the bottom a couple more years and only recently has started picking up and is still significantly below the levels of employment that it had in the prior to the peak of the economy in late 2007, December 2007 to be exact. So this economy is really being propelled by what is happening in cities, big cities, and in particular in the Portland metropolitan area. If I had a Portland number on here, it would be a little bit steeper than that Oregon, that urban Oregon or Oregon number. And part of the reason for that is, and this is, again, I'm borrowing from a slide that I think I got right when I was here 5 years ago, is we use these terms as economists, recession and recovery. And recovery has kind of this implication that somehow when the economy returns, it will come back the way it left. It will come back to look like it looked before the recession. And in that sense, I think recovery is actually a misnomer, because you never get back the same jobs and same businesses that you lost. Economies don't simply, go in reverse and get back to where they were. They're always moving forward. They're always changing. And so you might get back to the level of economic activity you were at before, but it will be in a different form. And that's clearly the case with the Oregon economy. The economy that we have today, which is a little bit bigger statewide than it was prior to the recession in say 2005, 2006, is very different. And those differences are really important to understanding what drives the economy and where our opportunities are. So that's the sort of economic statistics on what happened in the last 5 years since I talked to you. We've recovered from a big recession. The statewide numbers look really good, but there's a big difference between urban and rural Oregon, and the housing market has fundamentally changed. I'm just going to pause there because I want to shift gears at this point. If there's something that I didn't say clearly, or if you have any questions at this point, I'd be happy to answer them. And I'm going to take a drink of water, so think of a question. Otherwise, it's more slides.
Start calling it the Great Recession?
I don't know. 2000, different people call it different things. And there seems to be a split between Great Recession and Lesser Depression. And I think settled on the Great Recession as nomenclature. But I'm not sure that's as widely agreed upon as Great Depression is. But it may just take a few more years before that name gets applied. Yes?
Average wage in the economy in general has gone up. So I wonder whether there's more statistics, more data show whether that's just a few people making 2 to 4 billion than the last time, taking the rest of us up with them, or is it generally spread out in the economy? I think it's the form.
Oh, that's a terrific question for which I did not, oops, sorry, I'm going to go back here just a sec, because I want to look at this chart and just talk about what it means. So this is the average wage and average income of Oregonians compared to Americans. So what I'm using this chart to show is how in the aggregate is the Oregon economy performing relative to the US economy? And the answer is a little bit better than it was a few years ago. Now to your question, which is a different question, which is the average wage of Americans and the average wage of Oregonians, and by average here I mean the wage of a typical person in Oregon, as opposed to averaging in Bill Gates's wages into all Americans' wages, is that increasing? And the evidence is it's come down some, that we've seen stagnation of wages for the typical person in our economy. So I think you're absolutely right about that. I didn't throw that slide in here, but I'm remiss in not mentioning that. Although I have to say, in the last 2-3 years, we're seeing the big effect here was the Great Recession. It drove down wages, and we're seeing some modest recovery, but we're still below the level we were, say, 10 years ago, and that's a big issue. And going forward, that is a very big issue as to whether we can grow the economy. The other thing that you alluded to is certainly true, which is inequality in the United States, the inequality of income, the disparity between the rich and the not so rich, is greater now than has been any time since 1929. No question about that. And that is a big issue. And one that I didn't devote much attention to because I wanted to talk about Oregon. Oregon is affected by that. That is true nationally. It plays out here pretty much the same way it does in other places. But you're exactly right. Any other questions? Okay. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, the economy is a very big, complex thing. If you're just talking about the Oregon economy, you're talking about on the order of 3.5 million people. You're talking about 1.6, 1.7 million people who get to go to work every day. You're talking about 100,000 businesses with a payroll. Most of those businesses we don't even know exist. Most of those workers we don't know. We don't know what other people do necessarily for their jobs. It's a very big, very complex system. How do we make sense of it? Well, we have certain kind of metaphors or simplifications that we use to think about and describe big, complex systems that are too big for us to know personally and individually. And in Oregon, we have a set of metaphors that we have used to describe our economy. And some of those metaphors you can find in Salem, Oregon. You can find them literally woven into the carpets in the House, House and Senate chambers. This is a building I used to work in. I've reflected on this a lot. So you go to the House chamber, Douglas fir trees are woven into the carpet of the chamber there, and the Senate, and in the Senate you have sheaves of wheat and salmon. And these metaphors really capture how we've thought about the Oregon economy for 100, 150 years. We've always viewed the economy as an extension of the natural landscape. The reason that there's an economy here is because there are trees growing in the forests, because we have abundant fertile plains and farmlands, and because some of us can go out in the ocean or in the river and catch salmon. And historically, those were all very accurate metaphors for describing the Oregon economy, especially in, say, the 19th century, and through perhaps the early part of the 20th century. But they still really influence our thinking, and I think they influence legislators, maybe because they glance down at their feet from time to time. So the Doug fir tree, is really indicative of the forest, the forests, the forest products industry, where we take big trees in this position and put them in this position and then make smaller pieces out of them and then ship them around the United States to make basically houses out of. On the Senate side, we have, Central and Eastern Oregon, which has the Columbia Basin, which is great wheat-growing territory. We bring it down to the ocean, down to tidewater, in elevators loaded on ships and sell it all over the world. Still an important activity, to be sure. But what's happened is it isn't that those traditional sources of economic activity have gone away, but the growth of the economy has increasingly been in the other parts of the economy. So at the top, we have the kinds of things that were the traditional sources of wealth, our natural resource-based, the costs of doing business, the proximity of us to nearby markets. But what's changed now is, and I'll talk about these, some of these ideas, knowledge, clusters, talent, and quality of life. All of those things are now much more important in shaping where economic activity occurs and how successful it is. And the way I describe it is we've moved from what I would call inherited assets, the resources that were here when, say, the white settlement occurred, to what I would call created assets, the kinds of things that we build here. Not just the physical things that we build, but the community and the knowledge and the social structures that we build in place. Because they turn out to be really, really important for growing industries and having successful industries. And the challenge for Oregon and a lot of other places is, you know, you have this resource economy, which is still important in many respects and particularly in a lot of communities. But where the big factors are that are influencing growth come from are really these created assets and our ability to generate, in particular, economically valuable new knowledge. And I'll talk about where that happens, why that happens in the balance of this talk. And it's been, you know, we can really see this transformation in Oregon. We see it, you know, in this, this is sort of the quintessential graph that shows what happened to the wood products industry, which employed close to 85,000 people in the late 1970s and which has declined to a little over half that today. And meanwhile, the high-tech industry has grown from, you know, a very tiny share of that to being substantially larger. But that's really indicative of a much broader transformation in the Oregon economy from resource-based industries to a whole series of knowledge and value-added industries. I'm sorry, I'm really clumsy with this technology today. So there are two big ingredients that come together to determine whether places are successful. And I'll go through these pretty quickly, but they're really basic. One is talent. And by talent, I mean the education and skills of the population. We're in a global economy today, and the biggest determinant of how successful you are as an individual, how successful your business is, how successful your community, your state is really dependent on the knowledge of the people, your knowledge, the knowledge of the people in your company, the knowledge of the people in your community. And I put that under the broad label of talent. And then the second issue is place, and I'll come to place in a minute, but let me talk to talent for a second. This is a chart that we use to measure what we call educational attainment. And educational attainment is just a fancy way of saying how long did you progress in school. And this is the relationship between the highest level of education that a person has completed and the typical earnings of that person. And you can see there's this really strong stair-step relationship. On average, the higher level of education you have, the more you earn. Now, obviously, your mileage will vary. Different people earn different amounts. But on average, somebody with a college degree earns more than somebody with a high school degree. This is what it looked like, you know, roughly 40 years ago, in 1975. This is what it looked like a few years ago. It's gotten a lot steeper, which is a fancy way of saying the returns to education have increased. Now, just go back. That's what it looked like. That's what it looked like. So, oops. This is how economists, oops, I'm very clumsy. Way again of saying the more education you have, the better, but that return to education has increased above what it used to be. And what's true for individuals, it turns out, is also true for places. Places with a better educated population have higher incomes. And this chart shows you basically the statistical relationship between the average level of education, that's shown on the horizontal axis, it's the percent of the adult population that has at least a four-year degree, and then on the vertical axis is the per capita income, the average income of all people living in a metropolitan area. These are the numbers for the 50 largest metropolitan areas. You get almost exactly the same chart if you do the 50 states in the United States. And what that line tells you is, that vertical line tells you, is that each one percentage point increase in the percent of the population with a four-year degree is associated with about a $760 increase in the per capita income of each individual in that metropolitan area. So there's a very strong relationship between more education and higher income. Question?
Is there a breakdown at all about age and how that?
Mm-hmm. I'm an economist, not a political scientist. That's the best dodge I can give you to that question. No, I think it's really tough, and I think we face some, you know, issues in communicating this. I think, just to step aside for, I think what we've lost is a really important point about, and there's one really important factor I'm leaving out of this chart is, higher education doesn't just raise the income of the people who get the education. That is, these places don't have higher earnings just for the people who have a four-year degree. People with only a high school education have higher incomes if they live in a place where there are a lot of people with a four-year degree. There are these social spillover impacts to education. And I think one of the things that's kind of pervaded the way we talk about education in the United States has been we only talk about it in terms of the benefits to the person who receives it. And we've lost sight of the fact that actually the whole community benefits if we're better educated. And if we don't talk about it in that way, then it's really hard to build a strong consensus across different communities, different age groups, different political parties about why this is important. Yes? Yeah, although I think, a lot of other, the big difference between now and 30 and 40 and 50 years ago is the rest of the world has caught up to the United States in terms of educational attainment. Basically, at the end of World War II, we had, if not a monopoly, we had a dominant position in people who had finished high school and who could speak English, okay? Now we represent a minority. If you look around the world, people who have the equivalent of a high school education and who are proficient in English, there are more of those people outside English-speaking countries than inside English-speaking countries, which is why a lot of the really simple, type manufacturing jobs can go anywhere. It's because you can easily find people with this fundamental set of skills, which is why now we have to up our ante and have to do better in order to be successful. New York is incredibly productive. I'll come to this, but basically one of the things that we know is cities, by concentrating talent and bringing smart people together and being places where ideas can happen quickly, make the economies more productive. That's what drives economic success, particularly for knowledge-based industries. So even though New York is really expensive and it's a pain to live there, it's difficult to get around, it's a great place for really cutting-edge businesses to do well. And the fact that New York is above that line tells you that. Houston has everything to do with the price of oil when we did these charts. But you can see almost everybody is pretty much right on those lines, that it's a very strong relation. So, and I could talk about any of these as much as you like, but let me move on. So, and a wonderful book by a guy named Ed Glazer, who's sort of the dean of American regional economists, said, this is really simple. At the local level, the most important economic development strategy is attract and train smart people. And again, I would just emphasize that. That's true. He writes it for cities, but it's true for any level of economic development. If your community is not attracting smart people, if it's hemorrhaging smart people, that's a problem, and that's something you need to pay a lot of attention to. And the next thing, and that brings me to talking about place, because we know that smart young people are choosing to live in some places and not others. And so understanding what they're interested in is really important from a standpoint of economics and economic development. And we've done a series of surveys. We did the first version of this survey almost 10 years ago. We did another version of it last year. And we asked a representative sample of well-educated young adults around the country this question: which of these two statements most closely resembles your beliefs in terms of a job and where you're going to live? One statement was sort of the traditional, I'm going to go wherever I need to go to get the best job that I can, and the location is secondary, or I'm going to choose where I want to live and then look for a job there. And by about a 2-to-1 margin, both a decade ago and then recently, well-educated young adults told us they're going to choose where they want to live and then look for a job there. So we know that place is really important to the location decisions of people. And we've done a series of other surveys, and the things that we hear are what we kind of shorthand as the new urbanist bullet points, that this move to the city is really dictated or governed by the interest in dense communities, diverse communities that are interesting and that are bikeable, walkable, and well served by transit. Now that doesn't hold for everybody, but it does hold disproportionately for people in this age group. And in our view, this is, you know, and I have to say another thing, you know, I've worked in economic development in the state of Oregon for more than 30 years, probably closer to 35 years. And I grew up in an era when economic development was all about, you know, how can we give the lowest cost of doing business? How can we cut taxes? How can we zone enough land for industry? That sort of thing. But I want to tell you that the world of economic development has changed fundamentally. And now the most important factor in economic development can be summarized by saying location decisions are dictated by the HR department. Where can the company find lots of workers that it needs, particularly talented and young workers, and where is it relatively easy to attract more if we need them? And that is governing the location decisions of a significant share of companies around the United States. This is a story that appeared, you know, not in Willamette Week or the Portland Oregonian, but actually the illustration and all on the front page of the business section of the Boston Globe last year. And it said, for tech job seekers, it's all about the city. For companies hoping to hire top talent, the fact is most tech workers want to live and work in the city. And in Boston has something called Route 128, which is sort of the beltway around the city. And that's traditionally where all the tech companies have been located. Lately, they've been leaving the suburbs, leaving the beltway, and setting up operations in Boston and in Cambridge, because that's where the workers, these plaid-shirted, coffee-drinking, bicycle-riding hipsters, live, and where if they're going to hire them or have an advantage in hiring them, they had better be located. And what we see happening in Boston, and for that matter in Portland, we see happening in an increasing number of cities. We did another report earlier this year called Surging City Center Job Growth, and I won't bore you with all the details, but for as long as we've been gathering economic statistics, jobs have been moving away from cities. Jobs have been suburbanizing. That's been true since, you know, the 1930s and 40s. But in the last 5 years for which we have data, jobs have been growing faster in cities than they have been in their surrounding suburbs. And we have a little chart that we did this exercise for Portland, and I won't bore you with the details, but that's what those charts show. I want to get through this a little bit more quickly than I have. And after we released that report, Cushman Wakefield, a big in commercial realtor, produced a report that counted since 2010, nearly 500 companies have expanded or located downtown. And the number one reason that they cite is the ability to attract and retain talented workers. So we know it's really a big factor, both economically and in terms of business decisions and decision making. And they tend to locate in places that are walkable, that are served by transit, and that do really well in terms of cycling as well. And the other thing that's really interesting is we track venture capital, and venture capital is investments in risky, fast-growing companies. And the great thing about venture capital investments is they're kind of a window into the future economy. So, you know, we have Google today, but 15 years ago, Google was a venture capital-funded company. And increasingly, venture capital investment has been going to companies that are located in these dense, walkable, urban environments, and not so much in the suburban office parks. These are some numbers put together by Richard Florida from a year ago. So, and I want to wind this up pretty quick so we have more time for questions. But all of this is leading to what I call a shortage of cities in the United States. We have lots of smart young people who all want, or I shouldn't say all, but who disproportionately want to live in cities and are moving to cities. We have companies who want to hire those folks who are expanding in cities. We have a national economy, and I showed you these numbers earlier, where cities are outpacing the national economy. And the fact that people are moving into cities rapidly is increasing the demand for urban living far faster than we're increasing the supply of opportunities to live in cities, which is why we're seeing rents going up why there are big ballot issues on in San Francisco, yes, and Seattle yesterday around housing issues and housing affordability. And that's sort of the tip of the iceberg. We see the same trends in other cities in the United States. We have a big demand for urban living, but we're not expanding the supply very rapidly, and that's creating a shortage. And one of the things that's really interesting, and this is these are numbers from Portland, is we've seen a total inversion in the real estate market in the Portland metropolitan area. So 10 years ago, the typical suburban house in the Portland area sold for about a $20,000 premium to the average house in the city of Portland. Okay, if you looked at the average of all houses in Clackamas and Clark and Washington counties, they sold for about $20,000 more than the average house in Portland. Now that has flip-flopped. The average house in the city of Portland sells for about $20,000 more than the typical house in those three suburban counties. And as an economist, that's sort of the most powerful evidence you could have of where the market demand is when the price of a city has changed relative to the suburbs. We did a post on this we called the Dow of Cities. This is like the Dow Jones Industrial Average for cities. If the price of it is going up faster than the rest of the market, that tells you that it's got increased value. And we did this earlier this year. Shortly after that, the folks at Fitch, the investment rating service, did essentially the same thing for the whole United States. And they found, and I'll just zoom in here, they basically divided the United States up into the densest parts and then the most suburban parts. And the dark blue line is the densest parts of the United States, and then the other lines are successive rings out from cities in the United States. And and these are average house prices. So basically, the houses in centers and cities in the United States have been appreciating faster than the rest of the real estate market in the United States since about 2000. Now there's this big bubble, we all remember this bubble in the housing market. That happened everywhere, but even through that bubble, there was a divergence between the price of houses in cities and the price of houses in the rest of the marketplace. And again, we take that as growing demand for cities. And part of that is related to the fact that then this is essentially the same chart I showed you for the U.S. as I showed you for Oregon earlier. In this recovery, it's been metropolitan economies, this light blue line, that's grown faster than all the smaller economies. The light blue line is metros with a million or more population. These are smaller metros, the blue and the orange line, the yellow line is basically rural areas in the United States, which are, again, just as in Oregon, recovering much more slowly. And that wasn't true in the previous recession. I don't know if I have that chart. I don't think I do. Portland is growing faster than the U.S. economy, same trend. Portland, in fact, over the last year, is basically the fifth fastest growing economy in the United States, this fifth fastest growing metropolitan economy. So the fact that we do have a successful metropolitan economy is helping drive the state economy and creates opportunities for a lot of folks. And Multnomah County, obviously, is a big part of that. It's leading the Portland region in job growth. Again, in Portland, it's not Washington and Clackamas and Clark counties where the job growth is happening. It's chiefly in Multnomah County where that job growth is happening. The final thing that I just want to touch on here in this set of slides is to come back to this theme I talked about earlier of about housing and how housing has changed. And these are some numbers from the Urban Institute, which is a big think tank in Washington, D.C. that tracks the housing market. And these are their predictions for the next 15 years for what happens to home ownership by age group in the United States. That dark blue line at the top is people in the 45 to 65 age bracket. That's this line. They expect the number of homeowners in that age group to decline pretty steadily, but slowly over that period. The light blue line here is homeowners under age 45. They expect that number to be basically unchanged for the next 15 years. No net increase in homeowners under 45 years of age. All of the growth of home ownership in the United States for the next 15 years, according to the Urban Institute, is this orange line, people 65 and older. So we're basically in a housing market where It's a lot of increasingly older Americans who are the homeowners. And younger Americans are not expected, according to Urban Institute, and there are some other studies that corroborate this, to be homeowners. So I think that's a fundamental reason to think that single family construction is not going to rebound sharply anytime soon. But what is happening, and we're seeing this again in cities around the United States, is a burgeoning demand for apartments and rental housing. Partly it's for reasons of taste, partly it's for reasons of economics. Like we had somebody comment on wage stagnation, wages are lower. We know that student debt is higher. We know that there's this different attitude about living in urban environments versus suburban environments. All of those things taken together are likely to, you know, fundamentally change the role of housing in the U.S. economy. So I may pause there. I have some slides I can talk about on myths and realities, but I know I've been covering a lot of ground here and pretty rapidly, and I want to be sure we have time for questions. It does in some cities. I think the New Yorks and Londons are probably, and to a lesser extent San Francisco's and Vancouver's, are influenced by that. I don't see a lot of evidence that Oregon is terribly influenced by it. It's in part influenced by, I think, Miami is another market where you see the same thing. And there, I think there are two big factors there. One is political risk, that people who live, you know, if you're an oligarch in Russia, maybe you're worried that you're on the outs sometime. So having real tangible investment outside that can't be expropriated by the government is a big factor. So certain markets are very attractive for that. Second is the weak rate of return on alternative investments. With a very low interest rate environment for a certain class of investors, which I would very much like to be part of, but I'm not, it makes a lot of sense to put money into expensive real estate in those very high-end markets. You think there's very little chance of collapse of housing prices in, say, New York or London. But I think those are pretty much exceptional markets. I think you do see some speculative activity in other markets. You know, we see it, in commercial real estate or real estate investment. But almost always that's predicated on the fact that they expect that there to be somebody to rent it to, as opposed to the, you know, Park Avenue $50 million penthouse condominium, which you might be holding to maybe sell someday to another oligarch or very wealthy multi-billionaire. Those properties are being purchased and maybe not on the market, but there's the expectation at some point you'll get really high rents for them and make money on your investment that way. But I don't think absentee ownership is a huge issue for us. Yeah, that's a very good question. And we've spent a lot of time, again, as I said, looking at where people are moving in the United States, which cities are gaining, which cities are losing, and worked in depth with 8 different cities around the country, including Portland, but Atlanta, Philadelphia, Kansas City, Memphis, Richmond, Providence, and a couple of others. Two things. One, there are some overarching trends that tend to affect everybody, and I think this kind of new urbanist bullet points and some of the generational change, I think those are things that affect lots of cities or that are in play. But then the other thing that we observed is different cities appeal to different people. And part of what's going on here is what a friend of mine who wrote a book on the subject called The Big Sort, that people are looking for places that fit them and their interests and where other similar like-minded people are likely to be going. And so for cities to be successful, I think they have to figure out what their DNA is. What is it about, you know, what is special about their city and what's special about their place so that they can, you know, find the people who will value that. And so, you know, we did a study for Atlanta, Georgia, and for Portland. Portland, no surprise to anybody, is not a mecca for young adult African Americans, okay? It isn't. I mean, it's becoming gradually more diverse all the time, doesn't do well. And one of the interesting things about young adult African Americans is they become more evenly distributed throughout the country over the last 2 decades. They're less segregated, less in the South and the industrial cities of the Northeast and Midwest. and more likely to be found in every metro in every neighborhood. There are two exceptions to that. One of those exceptions is Atlanta, Georgia. Atlanta was one of the places that had a significant concentration of well-educated young African Americans, partly because of historically black colleges, but was the place where a lot of them moved to, particularly in the 1990s, which caused a big increase. So different cities will appeal to different sets of people. Figuring out who you can appeal to, I think, is really important. So I think that's kind of a deep introspective kind of civic exercise to figure out, you know, what does your city care about, and who do you speak to? And in Portland's case, I think, observing Tom McCall and environmentalism and so on, I think a lot of who we ended up with was based on the values that we projected. You know, it wasn't that we figured everything out, but we signaled that this is a place that cares about these things, and come and you can participate and help us figure out how this stuff all works. And that's the other general characteristic I would say in terms of working with young people is, and when looking at different cities, in Richmond, I'll pick on Richmond right now, very closed political culture, very hard to break into. Other cities, and Portland is kind of the other end of this extreme, fairly permeable political structure where if you show up and you participate, you can have something to say about what is done. Now that's maybe one of the problems, is anybody can show up and participate. But different cities send different signals about who's allowed to get involved in the decision-making process and what's permissible to discuss about what we might change. And if your city says you're not welcome to participate and we won't consider, you know, vote by mail or death with dignity or legalizing marijuana, then there's a whole set of people who say, you know, I'm not going to engage. I'm not going to come to your community. Yeah, this is a terrific set of questions. Three things. First of all, you know, I said we want talent is critically important. The most important source of talent, the best investment you can make is in your kids, and doing a great job of educating your kids, whatever community you're in. I think Oregon statistically and historically has been above average. I don't think that's true anymore. I think we've slipped. Second thing is, we know where well-educated young adults, 25 to 34-year-old, largely childless people have been moving. The big question is, do they stay in cities? That's a research project we're working on called Kids in Cities, to see whether that's changing. We have some anecdotal evidence. The one factoid I can give you from Portland is, 7 or 8 years ago, Portland Public Schools was planning for declining enrollment, was closing schools, and on the advice of good demographic projections that said, look, you're not going to have any kids in schools. Today, they have 5,000 more students enrolled in Portland Public Schools than they did 6 or 7 years ago. They're putting up temporaries to house the students in the same school attendance areas where they were closing schools a few years ago. So there's at least the potential of, and we're seeing this in some other cities as well, but I think Portland, New York, and San Francisco are all a bit ahead of the curve. I think it's a big question going forward whether we can improve urban education to meet the demands that are going to be placed on it. And I think how good a job you do in education is probably going to be determine how well you hang on to those people, because they're people with resources and choices, and they can leave or exit the public school system too. So those are both issues, and I think it's also important from really an equity standpoint too, that, you know, as I said, education doesn't just benefit the people who receive it. Living in a community where everybody gets a good education redounds to our collective benefit, both economically and socially. I don't know the answer to that question. We haven't looked. Yeah, that's a very specific data question. I would hesitate before I'd speculated on what the answer was. That's a great question. Yeah. How much does everybody want to geek out on this question? Because this is a really nerdy economic question, or several nerdy economic questions. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the cost of living is one that's really interesting to look at, particularly geographic variations in the cost of living, because the kind of indexes we use don't pick up the differences in people's consumption habits in different places, and in particular, they don't pick up the availability of the variety of goods in different places. So there are some things that you can buy in Astoria or in Oregon or in a city at a reasonable price that you, black cod, beautifully baked black cod like tonight, fresh, okay? You can't buy that at any price in most places in the United States. Or, there are a lot of other things that way too. So price comparisons between places usually look at only very standard commodities, a gallon of gas, a gallon of milk, a pair of blue jeans. Those variations don't matter very much to anybody. It's the things that you can't buy at any price that really make the difference to the standard of living. The second problem is some places enable you to live in a different way. What I mean, and one set of studies we've done in the Portland metropolitan area, people drive about 20% less than the average resident of a large metropolitan area in the United States. Typical American drives 25 miles per person per day. Typical person in the Portland metropolitan area drives about 20 miles per person per day. Okay, when you do the math, 365 days a year, 40 cents a mile, 2.2 million people living in the Portland metropolitan area. People in the Portland metropolitan area spend $1 billion a year less on cars and gasoline than they would if they behaved the way other Americans do. That's not captured in anybody's cost of living index. But the fact that we have more compact development, better transit, people walk and bike more, saves them out of their pocket $1 billion a year, which is one of the reasons why Portland has the third highest level of restaurants per capita of any place in the United States. And Visa just put out the study on this, which I was gratified to see. 20% of the money that people don't spend on gas goes straight to restaurants. So cost of living comparisons, the ones that get done really miss the important things that differ from place to place. They're biased in an important statistical way. And then we do price indexes, but we don't do quantity indexes or market basket indexes that look at the differences of market baskets. I mean, because if you live in Houston, plan on driving about 30 or 35 miles a day on average. Okay, you're going to need another car. You're going to spend that much more on gasoline. And very quickly, the price of a house in Houston, which looks a lot cheaper, and then you add in the air conditioning bill, and then you're living in Houston. Okay, somebody said the definition of an economist is somebody who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. And maybe that's a good line to finish with. Okay. Oh, yeah, happy to take as many questions as people have.
Described as food for the mind, the 23rd annual Columbia Forum Series offers speakers on myriad topics around the region and the world. The events are held at the Columbia Memorial Hospital Community Center in Astoria. The next event is Thursday, February 18th. The speaker will be author Tricia Gates Brown. Her topic, Understanding the Value of Mythologies. The forum is sponsored by the Daily Astorian, Cannery Pier Hotel, and the OSU Seafood Lab. Columbia Forum is broadcast on Coast Community Radio on 4th Sundays and offered as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. Thank you for listening. This is Coast Community Radio.